Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. My guest today is David Robson. David is an award-winning science writer and editor who specialises in writing in-depth articles probing the extremes of the human mind, body and behaviour. He was a features editor at New Scientist for 5 years and is currently a senior journalist at BBC Future. He regularly features on the BBC World Service discussing scientific issues, and his writing has also appeared in The Guardian, The Atlantic and The Washington Post. His first book, The Intelligence Trap, Why Smart People Make Stupid Mistakes and How to Make Wiser Decisions, was published earlier this year, and this will be the topic of our discussion today. Well, hello, David. Welcome to the Middleway Society podcast.
Hi, it's completely my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Brilliant. Okay, well, perhaps you can begin, David, by just telling us a bit about yourself and what it was that prompted you to write the book.
Sure. So, I guess my interest in intelligence goes back to when I was a child here in the UK, and I was kind of brought up in Yorkshire, but then I moved down to Kent in the south of the country. And there, when you get to senior school, you have to take the 11 plus, which is a form of the IQ test. And so, you know, I always wondered kind of what it was about those questions that could predict whether you were kind of suitable to having a grammar school education that was meant to be kind of more sophisticated than you would get in a comprehensive school. But then, you know, so that had always been on my mind. But then it was really when I became a science journalist, specializing in psychology, and especially my work at New Scientist, that I really began to probe that a bit more deeply. And partly what had really kind of prompted the question of why smart people can also act stupidly was the fact that I would often interview and speak about and hear about some of these really great minds, like really, you know, Nobel Prize winning geniuses, who then had these really stupid beliefs or behaviors that just didn't seem compatible with their apparent intelligence and education. You know, one of my favorite examples I mention in the beginning of the book is this guy, Kerry Mullis, who designed this process called the polymerase chain reaction, which is incredibly complex, but is also really the foundation of all the genetics testing that's so fundamental to medicine and biology today. So, you know, there's no doubt that he was an incredibly intelligent and creative man. But the problem is that he also had these really odd beliefs that I think are quite dangerous, some of them. So, for instance, he denied the link between the HIV virus and AIDS. He was very prominent in that AIDS denialism movement. And he also has denied the link between man-made carbon emissions and the global rise in temperatures that we see with climate change. So, you know, these are really issues, and you'd think as a scientist he should have had a more rational view of the scientific evidence, but he you know, for some reason he was going against that consensus, and that really fascinated me.
Well, let's dive in then. So what basically is the intelligence trap?
So I think maybe the best way to explain it is to think of it in the terms of a metaphor. And so I would say that, you know, we have these kind of intelligence tests that can measure your raw brain power, and we also have kind of education that kind of adds factual knowledge to that, and together you could think of intelligence and education as being like a car's engine. Now, it's really useful for a car to have a really powerful engine. It means it can move more quickly towards its destination, and there's no denying that fact. And similarly, there's no denying the fact that intelligence and education do bring about a lot of advantages to an individual in their lifetime. But with a car, you need to have the kind of checks and balances to make sure that it can navigate safely. So things like the GPS and good steering and brakes. And similarly, what you need is to have with intelligence and education, you also need to have these checks and balances that can guide your thinking. otherwise, just like a car with a fast engine but with no brakes, you might find yourself driving up a cliff. And I think that's very much what we see with people like Carey Mullis, is that they have this amazing engine of thought, but they're not really applying it correctly. And so actually sometimes that engine can backfire and lead them further astray than if they had been less intelligent or less educated.
Okay. To what degree do you think hubris plays about? Do you think, well, I'm obviously really intelligent, and you get a lot of this feedback that you've done these great things, then you perhaps sit on your laurels too much, you don't question things?
Absolutely. So I certainly think that is there is a role for that. And actually, it's only recently that scientists have tried to kind of prove that. But they have looked at this phenomenon that they call earned dogmatism. And that is where someone's perception of their own intelligence and expertise just makes them even more certain of their convictions and more dogmatic and more closed-minded. Now, the problem is that we actually independently see that people who are more open-minded, who actively look for evidence that contradicts their views, are actually much better at all kinds of rational decision-making. So that's a real problem, in my opinion. The earned dogmatism can actually lead people astray. They might feel that they've earned the credentials to be dogmatic, but everyone needs to keep an open mind and to question their assumptions.
Sure. And presumably, I'm just thinking of this whole idea of cognitive dissonance. You know, if you have two sort of conflicting cognitions or thoughts, often it's quite painful. Say, for example, you know, I'm a smoker and I've got two thoughts, like I really fancy a cigarette, but I also have another thought that this is really bad for me. So you get this dissonance in the middle. But I imagine if you're intelligent and educated, you've actually got more tools to articulate your way out of that dissonance. You can sort of kid yourself a bit better, perhaps.
Yeah, you're totally right. So this phenomenon is called motivated reasoning. And so we see that a lot with discussions of politics, you know, the huge polarization we see with Brexit or beliefs about climate change or gun control in the United States. And there, what you find is that actually, if you have someone with a very strong belief and they come across evidence that contradicts that belief, then they do, as you said, they try to rationalize why that evidence might be wrong. Now, the fact is that the more intelligent people and the more educated people are much better at formulating the argument and rationalizing it. So you actually find that often they're dismissing evidence that really is quite valid, but they think they found a loophole and they've kind of constructed this illusory argument that backs up their belief. Yeah. And that can explain the polarization that we see. And what's really striking to me from these results is that you actually see that the more intelligent someone is and the more educated they are, the more polarized they become on those particular issues. So intelligence and education, rather than helping people to come to an agreement about the facts, is actually pushing them apart. And that's totally the opposite of what I would have expected from my kind of own intuitions about what intelligence and education should do for someone's reasoning. You'd hope that the more intelligent people are, the more likely they would be to come to an agreement about what these basic facts are showing.
Fascinating, yeah. So there've been lots of attempts to try and measure intelligence in the past, and you mentioned the IQ test, which is perhaps the most well-known. Now, all of these arguably have been problematic to varying degrees. So would it have been perhaps a lot easier if we'd had a more adequate definition of what intelligence is in the first place? I mean, it's not like in this idea of the intelligence trap has not surfaced before in history. I mean, Socrates was a great example, right? going out into the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, I think actually the idea of the intelligence trap has such a strong philosophical pedigree. So there's Socrates, but also Descartes has said about the greatest minds have the greatest vices as well as the greatest virtues. And, you know, very much like the kind of car metaphor that I mentioned, he spoke about how a quick mind can just get you to the wrong conclusion even more quickly. So I agree there. And it was only really in the early 20th century that we started to have like any kind of measure of intelligence at all. And that was absolutely confined to kind of academic intelligence. You know, they were designed to predict how well people would perform at school and university. And those tests, those IQ tests, which we still use today, different forms of them, different variations, they are actually very effective at predicting someone's academic record. So I wouldn't want to kind of diss those particular tests or to deny that they can be very useful in certain applications. But I think what the problem has been is that those tests, they're not the kind of sum total of someone's mental worth. And the person who originally came up with them, a guy called Alfred Binet in Paris at the turn of the century, you know, he had always made this argument that it was, you know, should be restricted to this one academic field. But other people have kind of extrapolated on his work and tried to claim that they really do represent this kind of overall reasoning ability. I would still define intelligence essentially using those tests. I feel like that definition is just so ingrained now, there's no point in really changing that. And, you know, because we do know that they kind of correspond to this overall ability for abstract reasoning and complex information processing. But I think we also have to look for these other traits that are important. So there's the theory that I prefer best is this idea of that there are three different types of intelligence, and the abstract intelligence is one important component, but you also have creative intelligence and practical intelligence. And that has now been validated using really good scientific research, that actually these three components are very important for all kinds of success in life.
And if we've got those in balance, then we're more likely to make better decisions.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, I think, like, so say if you look at practical intelligence, this work is by Robert Sternberg, who I believe is at Yale University at the moment. But he, you know, his work is really fascinating because he had shown that people's ability to kind of carry out their plans in a pragmatic way, so even stuff like prioritizing your tasks, doesn't actually correspond very well to people's IQ scores, so to the abstract intelligence. So they are different capabilities. But actually, I think anyone would say that actually that is a really important component of someone's mental toolkit, to be able to, you know, plan their day ahead or the week ahead and work out what needs to be done first and what needs to be done last. So it's that kind of element that I think we had been missing, but is now being studied and included in these new tests.
Yeah, exciting. Okay, well, but I'm just wondering from an evolutionary perspective, this idea of being intelligent yet blinkered in our thinking, it seems something of a conundrum. So how might we account for that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is some of the favourite research that I cover in the book, is looking at kind of what are the benefits of being kind of blinkered in our thinking and of having that kind of motivated reasoning that we spoke about. And actually, when you think about it carefully, there are some benefits. So we know that humans evolved, you know, very much in a social environment. Our brain power really comes from the kind of evolutionary pressure to be able to deal with all those complex social interactions as human group size increased over time in prehistory. And what you see when you think about all of these biases, things like the confirmation bias, is that actually in that kind of environment, it can be very useful to make your case very strongly in a very persuasive way. So we really evolved to be persuasive, to get the group to kind of see things the way we wanted to. Now, in those small groups, people, you know, you'd have other group members who would argue with you. And overall, the group as a whole should be able to kind of counteract each other's biases to come to a rational solution to the problem at hand. But the problem is that we don't always interact with people in that way anymore in the modern world. You know, the amount of information that's coming to us through the internet, through TV, in newspapers is just too great. And in the vast majority of cases, we don't have the kind of back and forth that you would have had in prehistory. So that really means that those biases that might have once served this kind of purpose in that particular setting actually just can kind of be amplified and really lead us astray in this new environment with so much information hitting our ears and our eyes.
So do you think we function better in smaller groups then?
Yeah, so that's it. So there's a lot of evidence for this, and I would definitely suggest that listeners go and read a separate book called The Enigma of Reason that kind of explains this argument in a lot more detail. But one example the authors of that book give is that actually when you look at these experiments looking at the psychology of the legal system, and you have like a group of jurors that often, like, the individual members come to it with very strong biases. But by the end, more often than not, they actually have counteracted their biases. And, you know, the jury system actually does work very effectively in lots of cases. Like, sometimes it's flawed, but in lots of cases, their group reasoning is much better than the individual reasoning. So it's that kind of evidence that we can see that actually small groups can be effective. I think the separate issue that also makes the modern world so bad is that we have lots of social affiliations which can kind of promote that motivated reasoning that we spoke about. So in the past, you know, you're part of the group and your membership of that particular group is all important. Whereas now, you know, you might be a Democrat, but you're arguing with a Republican. And you're very different groups, and you have very strong biases to kind of argue within the framework of your own group.
Yeah.
We didn't really have that so much in the past. And so I think it's all of these factors that are really important. But when we're in a group of like-minded people discussing a problem that maybe isn't too emotional, we are very effective at group reasoning.
You also argue in the book that it's not just general intelligence that's problematic, that expertise can also cause problems too.
Yeah, exactly. So that's really kind of extends the work, I think, that I've discussed about intelligence and education. But you see that actually expertise, you know, this kind of vast knowledge and skills that build up over years and years of experience, definitely obviously has its huge advantages. So it you know, leads to these kind of almost automatic judgments. So a doctor, for instance, often doesn't need to go through a patient's whole medical history to be able to diagnose them, or a radiologist can instantly find the tumour in a scan. And so that automatic intuitive reasoning that's caused actually by a rewiring of the brain often works very well for, you know, maybe 90% of the time. But the problem is that this automatic intuitive reasoning is also quite easily swayed and manipulated by our emotions or by other kind of totally irrelevant factors, you know, things like the weather outside or, you know, how some information is presented. It kind of opens you up for bias like that. So while the expert's reasoning is very efficient and very quick, it does also have these kind of errors that just hadn't been addressed previously. And so in medicine, for example, that can have really bad consequences. I think about 15% of initial diagnoses are wrong. And overall, diagnostic and medical errors are thought to cause more deaths than diseases like breast cancer or AIDS. So, you know, that's really significant. And in the past, these errors were seen as being kind of inevitable. They weren't really blamed on the expertise. They were probably blamed on just the fact that, you know, the problems are so difficult that they're dealing with. But now we realize that actually it is a product of the expertise, and that you can train these experts to think in a slightly different way that can mitigate those errors. So you can make kind of situations expert-proof as well as foolproof, and vastly improve their accuracy.
Great. Okay. I'm just wondering, though, that there seems to potentially to be a danger here that this understanding, though, can either be misunderstood or manipulated into this don't trust experts narrative that that you hear a lot on social media, that, for example, causes people to ignore the climate emergency that that experts tell us that we are facing. So how do you think we can minimise this?
Yeah, I mean, so that's something that within my book itself, I've tried very carefully to emphasise the fact that I don't, you know, that this isn't an argument, a kind of anti-intellectual argument, you know, because I still think we have to have huge respect for the amount of knowledge that these experts have, and to, you know, have our own humility that we probably know a lot less than people who have been studying a subject their whole life. But having said that, I don't think that we can also just let experts kind of rest on their laurels.
Yeah.
Because, like I mentioned, you know, these errors are really serious. They have a huge impact for individuals and for society as a whole. And that even we have to acknowledge that even experts can modify the way they're thinking to be even better. And that's really the message I would like to kind of contribute to that discussion.
Sure. So a sort of middle way there, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So back to your analogy that intelligence is a powerful runaway car, without the right steering or navigation to correct its course. If, as you say, intelligence is the engine of a car, education and expertise its fuel, what then are its steering and navigation system?
Right, yeah, great question. So there's, you know, as this research has evolved, psychologists have discovered lots of other traits and kind of mental habits that are really important to kind of ensure someone applies their intelligence in the best possible way. And I should say then that if you have great intelligence and all of these checks and balances, you know, then you're like really in a good position to make good decisions. To name a few of them, I would say this trait called active open-minded thinking that I mentioned earlier is absolutely essential. And so that is this habit, almost this kind of need and desire to look for the evidence that might counteract your opinion and to change your mind if you do find that evidence. And not everyone has that. We know it's a kind of spectrum, just like intelligence, but it can be kind of cultivated. Another one would be curiosity, which is important independently in learning, but for decision making, it's also hugely important. And that's partly because if someone's curious, if they just love finding out new facts, they're actually more open-minded in the way I just described. Yeah. So the two things are related, but independent. There's also just intellectual humility, you know, acknowledging that you might not know everything about a subject yet, and that there are these kind of limits to your knowledge and that you might be biased, and to kind of check and account for that. And scientific research has shown that all of these traits actually can be measured robustly and that they have a really profound effect on our decision making as much as intelligence does.
And there's an exciting new field of study in science called evidence-based wisdom that puts all these things together and is doing a lot of research in this area.
Yeah, that's right. So that really brings together a lot of the stuff I've just spoken about, really. And it's really this attempt to kind of comb the philosophical literature to find out, you know, how have philosophers defined wisdom, and then to use that to build robust scientific measures, looking at things like intellectual humility or the capacity to take different perspectives and to combine different viewpoints into a compromised position. And they, you know, they've done this. There are various tests which do seem to be reliable. So some of them just involve presenting these kind of dilemmas, the kind of thing you might read in an agony aunt column or, you know, a political crisis somewhere in the world, and to get people to reason out loud and then to measure them on those different traits. And what they found is that those scores actually do a lot more to predict someone's overall kind of health and well-being, various aspects of their lives, than intelligence. So we can see that they're actually two separate kind of qualities, intelligence and wisdom, and that actually wisdom in itself is worth measuring and worth cultivating.
Okay. And you also talk about our emotional compass, something that can powerfully direct the quality of our intuition and decision making. What elements constitute that?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of the scientific research that I explored. So there's three elements to your emotional compass. And the idea here, just to kind of emphasize why it's important, is that even though kind of analytical thinking is essential for good decision making, that actually our emotions and intuitions do play an important role, but you just need to know how to read them in the best possible way. So the first is element of this kind of process of reading your emotional compass is interoception, which is this kind of sense of what's happening in your body at the moment. So, you know, just are you feeling butterflies in your stomach? Are you feeling a bit sweaty? Is your heart racing? All of these things that actually are really important for signaling when you're feeling an emotion. Now, not everyone is as good at that as other people are. So, you know, again, it's like a spectrum, just like intelligence. You can measure it quite easily. I give this kind of test called the heartbeat test, where you kind of just measure how well you are at reading your heartbeat, and that actually gives you an idea of your interoception. And you can see that people who are more sensitive are often much better at this kind of emotional decision making. They're better at reading the kind of non-conscious signals that are coming to them and just going with that gut instinct and making sure it's accurate. But there are other elements of it too. So a second is this kind of thing called emotional differentiation. So that is actually being able to pick apart the feelings that you are sensing and put a precise label on it. And again, not everyone is equally good at this. So, you know, I know lots of people who kind of have two emotional words, you know, it's either good or bad, or, you know, they're really stressed or really happy. It's actually, we have this kind of whole rainbow of different feelings. You know, there's not just the kind of basics like excitement or joy, but also those kind of foreign words that you that we're now incorporating into the language, things like schadenfreude or hygge, the kind of Danish idea of feeling cozy. It's a very particular feeling. And actually, the better people are at kind of precisely describing their feelings in that particular way, the better their decision making again.
I'm just thinking there as well, I'm a Samaritan, and one of the things in our interactions with people who are phoning is to try to in a sense develop the vocabulary of emotion. So someone might phone up and say, I'm just feeling shit, something like that, and so you say, well, you know, and so you try and unpack what shit means for them, and often when that gets a bit more nuanced, they get often a bit more insight into actually how they're feeling.
I think that's really important, and you know, because often you know, lots of feelings are kind of bittersweet, like I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it right, but there's that Japanese term that I think is called wabi-sabi or wabi-sabi, and you know, I think that means kind of the kind of beauty in seeing like something decay. And you know, it's like we didn't used to have that term in English, but actually when you start to pick apart your feelings, you might realize that even if you're feeling bad, you can learn from that experience. And that there might be this kind of tinge of hope around it that could be really useful for you to acknowledge. So I think that is really important in and of itself. But what is important is that emotion differentiation also leads to the third part of the emotional compass, and that is emotional regulation. So that is just knowing kind of how to account for your feelings and control them. You know, sometimes just putting the label on a feeling is enough to kind of moderate it, but there's also lots of other ways of reappraising the situation, reframing it, and some people are better at that and some are worse. And again, we see that people who are better at that are better at lots of different kinds of decision making, often ones that might seem like totally rational decision making. Actually, people with more refined emotional awareness are much better at those kinds of problems too.
Obviously meditation comes to mind here with helping with these things. Meditation, when is something that can help you arguably to respond more adequately to your experience rather than react to it. I think, I mean, I'm a fairly regular meditator, and I've learned, for example, so much from just having an itchy nose, because you know, because when you sat there and you make the decision not to scratch it, there's a real intensity there. You know, you get emotionally hijacked almost by that urge to scratch your nose. But if you don't do that, and don't do that, I've not scratched my nose hundreds of times now, I think viscerally almost that ability to not, you know, not get caught and not to have to react, I think just helps me perhaps when I'm in traffic and someone, you know, gives me the finger and I can just sort of catch myself a little bit. I don't know if that, does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And so there has been this research showing that actually regular meditators do seem to perform better on these decision-making tasks, because they kind of avoid that emotional reactivity that they might have. So, you know, for something like if you're encountering someone with completely opposite political opinions to you, but you're used to that idea of like sensing your emotions and processing them and stepping back and avoiding that reactivity, you can easily see how meditation, the regular practice of meditation, would actually help you then to have a more fruitful discussion and to appraise the evidence for what it is, rather than just feeling annoyed that, you know, you're talking to someone who's disagreeing with you and you know, like threatening your worldview. So I think you absolutely see that. And, you know, even some of these kind of cognitive biases that people like Daniel Kahneman had studied, so stuff like the it's called the sunk cost effect. And, you know, this is where you kind of pour lots of resources into a failing project because you're so attached to your initial investment that you kind of you can't bear to see that fail and to lose that initial investment. But actually, you end up losing a lot more money in the long run because you just didn't know when to stop. And again, you see people who are better at this kind of emotional awareness and differentiation and reappraisal are actually less susceptible to that kind of flawed decision making because of that.
And you also stress the importance of cultivating a tolerance of ambiguity.
Yeah, that's really important because I you know, like, and this is something that I think is totally ignored in like traditional academic tests, is that you're often just presented with facts or ideas in a very well-defined way, and you're rewarded for making like a very clean argument. Definitely, you know, when I was even subjects like English or history, it was all about your kind of rhetoric and the kind of your capacity to build the data to suit your own argument, rather than maybe kind of having this more nuanced view of the facts and this recognition that actually lots of situations are ambiguous and you can make a good guess about what might, you know, what might be true, what might not be true. But you could also recognize that you don't have 100% confidence in that and that your opinion could change with new data. And that is just something we're not very good at cultivating in our education system, but that actually, you know, is absolutely fundamental to being a good thinker, is to recognize that sometimes situations are messy, and just simply acknowledging that fact is sometimes just all you need to do to look for the way out of the situation.
Okay, what's truthiness, David? And how can an understanding of it help us to avoid taking in misinformation from the media?
Right, so truthiness is that when, you know, I've spoken just now a lot about how you kind of have this, a lot of our decision making does rely on intuitions and gut feelings, and truthiness is very much part of that. So it's when we read a statement, you know, does it just feel like it must be true? And some statements do feel a lot more true than others, even if they're actually false. And it's all to do with the way it's presented and lots of irrelevant factors that lots of people just aren't aware of. So, you know, in kind of written documents, it's often just to do with like the font. Like, is the font easy to read or difficult to read? If it's easy to read, it feels more truthy. But also if you see a pundit on the TV, something like the familiarity of their face, have you seen them lots of times before, makes their statements feel more truthy. Similarly, if they're speaking in an accent that's quite similar to your own, they feel more honest as a result, even though none of that should really affect whether someone is telling the truth or not. If you go back to kind of climate change deniers, the BBC has featured people like Lord Lawson very often as a climate change denier, despite the fact he has no background in climate science. The mere fact that he's been on the TV and radio so often now means that his statements to lots of people in the population feel more truthy. So he's just more believable just because they know who he is. So you can see this is a real problem for misinformation and fake news, because if we're just looking at the kind of intuitive feel of a fact, it just allows like lots of misinformation to spread very quickly.
Yeah, I think I heard something recently that 10 out of the last 11 presidents have been taller than the person they were campaigning against, you know, in the opposite party.
Yeah.
I think that's called the halo effect. It's a similar, I suppose it's connected to the truthiness. Okay, well, let's move on to something we advocate strongly in the Middle Way Society is critical thinking. Now, while you stress that it's really important that we understand and internalise the most logical fallacies, and you give a list of about 6 or 7 in the book, which you really strongly suggest we should memorise, such as straw man arguments, appeals to authority, etc. You do suggest that something called inoculation theory is a more hands-on and accessible way of doing this. Could you explain what that is, please?
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, I think like any education in critical thinking probably is useful, but I think the difficulty here is that lots of people just might know kind of theoretically about these logical fallacies, but it can be quite difficult to apply them if you've only learned about them in a very abstract way. But what researchers are finding is that actually, by teaching people these principles through real-life examples of misinformation, that is much more effective at protecting people from misinformation in the future. So one of the experiments, for instance, used examples from the tobacco industry in the 1970s and earlier, and the ways they were trying to kind of spread the idea of there being kind of controversy or disagreement about the link between smoking and cancer. And what they did was they kind of taught these participants kind of what they were doing, how they were spreading that misinformation, and then presented them with information from climate change deniers and these kind of documents that might initially seem very convincing, but actually when you pick them apart, their argument falls to pieces. Now, what they found was that kind of all participants as a whole after the inoculation were much better able to recognize the misinformation and they were resistant to it. But what was especially important here was equally true no matter what their political background was. And like I'd mentioned previously, you know, for issues like climate change, this motivated reasoning is really important. So people who come from a more kind of capitalist kind of background are much more likely to deny climate change. But having been inoculated and been taught these kind of logical fallacies through that one example of the tobacco industry, which is totally unrelated, but having had that inoculation, they too were resistant. They were overcoming their motivated reasoning, overcoming that kind of emotional pull and seeing the facts for what they really were. So that's really promising that people really can learn and, you know, they can learn in one field and then it can be, they can learn to apply it to like all different kinds of misinformation. It's like an umbrella effect
there. Yeah, that's a really exciting thought, actually. Yeah. Let's move on to curiosity. Now, curiosity is something we have normally we have in abundance when we're very young. But for many of us, we seem to lose that. And I'm not quite sure why that happens. But how critical do you think curiosity is to help us make better decisions? And how can we maintain and cultivate it?
So, you know, I think curiosity is just absolutely essential. And I don't really like the word stupid at all. Yeah. But if I was going to define what I think stupid is, I would say it's not a lack of kind of general intelligence. But for me, it would be that kind of lack of curiosity where you just, you know, someone just doesn't really want to know about the world around them or to kind of uncover the facts. They're just quite happy knowing what they know already. And that's enough for them. And so, you know, we find that curiosity is like essential in learning and education because it really helps you to cement memories, and that's independent of someone's IQ. You know, the more curious they are about something, just the much easier they find it to learn the material. So curiosity in that particular case is already like one of our most important traits. But what you also find is that curiosity can protect us from that motivated reasoning that I mentioned, and it's almost just like this drive and this desire and this hunger for new information overcomes all of those other emotional pulls that might contribute towards motivated reasoning, that might pull your car off of its track, because it doesn't matter what, you know, your political background is. If you find this kind of new study that contradicts what you believe, you want to learn about it and you want to understand it, because the very fact of understanding it is satisfying in and of its own right. It doesn't need to agree with your worldview to be inherently interesting.
Sure. Okay. And then from a real pragmatic, practical sense, you know, what does this all mean for how we teach our children today? I mean, to what degree are these ideas that you've been talking about the last 10, 15 minutes, to what degree are they being applied in various education systems around the world? How would you like to see things evolve and change in education, especially in our own in the Western culture?
Yeah, so that's something I feel really passionate about. So you know, one of the problems with the Western education systems, and especially the UK and the USA, is kind of what I hinted at earlier, and it's that fact that we're not really encouraged to be very deep thinkers, and we reward much more superficial thinking of, you know, not just your memory, but, you know, can you create that persuasive argument rather than can you really deal with confusion and uncertainty and ambiguity? Now, we see the opposite in Eastern cultures, especially Japan is the kind of primary case study, where teachers actually encourage their children to embrace confusion and that difficult feeling of frustrating when you don't quite understand something. You know, they might give them a problem that is they know is going to be too difficult for the students to solve, possibly because they haven't even learned the rules that they need to apply to solve that problem. But the children, you know, will persevere, and that process of going through the confusion and then eventually maybe being told the answer, well, for one thing, it actually enhances learning. So they learn more of the facts than if you're like just spoon-fed the material through these kind of very easy to read, very attractive textbooks and, you know, being told everything step by step. But more importantly, I think that prepares the mind for, you know, all of those difficult problems that we have to face from day to day. It makes us less reliant on whether something feels truthy, because you're used to dealing with confusion. So you don't shy away from a fact that doesn't feel truthy, but might be true. You actually just, you look at the details rather than just the intuition. And that's something I would really like to see applied in Western education systems, to train people to be resilient thinkers who can deal with confusion and who can look deep into a problem rather than always skating over the surface and assuming that actually the easier something is, the kind of better it is. Sometimes it's just great to deal with difficulty.
I'm thinking that this East and West, that arguably Western cultures have more of what could be described as a growth mindset, where intelligence is seen perhaps more as a skill to be cultivated and developed, whereas there's a tendency in the West to see intelligence as something innate, like the colour of your eyes.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think that's almost why we shy away from, you know, anything that feels too difficult or confusing. Because if we have that kind of fixed mindset that you described, if we assume intelligence is this kind of trait that is unchangeable, and then we find a problem that we aren't smart enough to solve yet, that's like a real hit to our ego. So we just kind of shy away from the confusing stuff and just stick to the kind of stuff that's easy to process, and we much prefer that. And you definitely see that within schools. You know, there's lots of research showing, like I mentioned, that the more confusing material is, the more frustrating it is, actually, the better students learn. But in the West, like, students hate it, teachers hate it, parents hate it, because they can't overcome that feeling that if you're learning well, it should feel easy. But if you have a growth mindset, you're a bit more predisposed to accepting that something challenging could actually be very rewarding in the end.
And then in the book, you argue that the same problems that occur on an individual level are also mirrored in groups. And, you know, that you see this same blinkered thinking when people get together, like, for example, in teams.
Yeah, exactly. So I mentioned, you know, that there's research showing that actually jurors are very good at kind of problem solving and counteracting each other's biases overall. So, you know, in that particular case, group decision making does work quite well. But actually, there's lots of situations, and it all depends on the dynamics of the teams and the particular problems you're trying to solve, where group decision making can be pretty disastrous. The problem often is where you have one or two individuals who try to dominate, and they kind of just quash everyone around them. And then you actually see that that those teams perform terribly, even if the IQs of all the individual members is very high. There's also this phenomenon known as the too much talent effect. And that is where you have so many high performers within a group that they just start kind of butting egos with each other. The cooperation breaks down and their performance drops as a result. So you see that in sports, and especially in the past, like in the 2016 Euros championships. You know, England's kind of humiliating defeat really could be put down to this too much talent effect. Whereas Iceland, on the other hand, you know, didn't really have any kind of big star players. I think one of their players played for Swansea, but, you know, most of them weren't in the kind of really top 30 clubs within Europe. Yeah. They just weren't the kind of household names. But actually, as a team, their cooperation was amazing. And it's almost like because of they had less talent as individuals, they actually had more talent as a team. So I think that really shows you actually that the intelligence trap does apply not just to individuals, but you see it in much bigger groups.
Yeah. Well, one thing you haven't mentioned or I didn't pick up is friendship. I'm just thinking in a friendship where, for example, you've managed to strike a good balance between reassurance and challenge, aren't then those friends in a particularly good position to sort of notice and nudge you with regard to the blind spots that we all have?
Yeah, that's totally it. So I think like the important thing is to surround yourself with people who respect you but don't always agree with you. Because what you want is people to be able to talk to you in a kind of collaborative and kind of compassionate way, but also to not shy away from disagreeing with you and from highlighting your own flaws. And very much, I think that's where our friends and the people around us are one of the best ways to kind of reduce the biases in our decision making. The problem is that lots of very intelligent people don't want to hear that or won't believe their friends if they do say it. But if you can surround yourself with the right kinds of people and you do listen to what they say, then that's really important.
Yeah, okay. The middle way, David, as we understand it in the middle way society, is the idea, roughly, that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things. That then throws us back an experience. So we're left in this sort of messy, as you were talking about earlier, messy, uncertain middle. But it's arguably in the messy, uncertain middle that we can perhaps actually get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
You know, I think that's really relevant. And so I would definitely say that's something people should take away from my book, is that actually you can just embrace that kind of messy uncertainty. And one of my favorite examples of this actually is that members of the US Navy, especially those working on submarines, often talk about the benefits of chronic uneasiness, which I think is really what we're talking about actually. And I'm not talking about this pathological anxiety,
yeah.
But I think it's always good to feel slightly uncertain about your position on all these different topics and to always be questioning. And, you know, we've just got so much brilliant evidence now showing that it might not always be comfortable, but eventually the long-term gains and the benefits for you and for the people around you are so much greater if you can just tolerate that kind of chronic uneasiness, yeah, rather than always trying to feel certain in your opinion.
Sure, yeah. Okay, well, what I found especially encouraging and inspiring from the book is that studies show that intellectual humility is actually a better predictor of academic achievement than the IQ test. To quote you from your book, David, about such research, everyone with higher intellectual humility performed better, but crucially, it was of most benefit for those with lower intelligence, completely compensating for their lower natural ability. The principles of evidence-based wisdom can help anyone to maximise their potential. This really actually gives me hope. How has the process of writing and researching the book affected you? Have you noticed any change in the efficacy of your own decision-making through this process? And has it made you more hopeful, perhaps, too?
I think it has made me more hopeful because, like you say, it kind of really emphasises this point that anyone can improve their learning and their decision making, you know, so that we have a huge amount of potential we're just not using at the moment because we've been focusing on a very narrow kind of band of skills when all of these other skills are so important for all kinds of careers, academic careers as well as practical careers. You know, there's amazing potential for anyone, whatever their field, to really improve their thinking. In terms of my own decision making, I guess I have tried to embrace that idea of chronic uneasiness. So I just feel much less certain of how I feel about all kinds of issues. It doesn't mean I don't feel passionately about them, but I guess I'm just always looking for the evidence that might contradict what I'm thinking about and always open to that possibility. And maybe finding that actually that can be quite a joyful position to be in, to realise there's so much more to learn about the world, yeah, around you. And in a way, that's also made me a little bit less cautious in the kind of decisions I make in life, I think, because it's made me realize that, you know, you can't always play it safe and that sometimes you have to embrace uncertainty and to push yourself out of your comfort zone to really, like, to learn all of those important things about life.
Sure, yeah. Just my last question, David. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Okay, so I would say that, so I do have a website, www.davidrobson.me. But the thing that I really do update quite regularly is my Twitter account. So my handle there is D_A_Robson. And that's really where I share any new developments with the book or any new articles that I'm writing. So I would say that's the best place to go.
Brilliant. Okay, well, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you today, David.
Oh, thank you very much.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.